I'm Pierre Daly. This is Insider's Capital. The 60-40 portfolio didn't just underperform in 2022. It failed on its own terms, both legs down simultaneously in a year when diversification was supposed to be the point. That moment cracked something open in the advisor community, and the Canadian ETF market has been rebuilding around the fracture ever since. Nearly $1 in every $5 flowing into Canadian ETFs today is going into an asset allocation product, a new generation of alternative ballasts, covered calls, buffered strategies, market neutral, has gone from niche to mainstream. And beneath all of it, the plumbing of how ETFs actually trade, get priced, and find liquidity remains one of the most misunderstood corners of the advisor toolkit. My guest today has a view of this market that almost nobody else does. As head of global ETF strategy at RBC Capital Markets, Valerie Grimba sits at the center of a desk that serves as designated broker to roughly 300 ETF mandates, and acts as an authorized participant across more than 90% of the Canadian ETF market. She and her team spend their days working with everyone from the largest pension funds to family offices, helping them transact, trade, and think more clearly about ETFs. When Valerie talks about how this market is evolving, she's not reading the same research you are. She's watching the flows in real time. Today, we're covering a lot of ground: the RBC house view, the structural shift that 2022 set in motion, covered call ETFs and what most advisors are still getting wrong about them, where the real fixed income opportunity sits without reaching into dangerous duration territory, the rise of precision thematic strategies, and the one ETF liquidity misconception that Valerie's desk corrects almost every single day. Stick around, we'll be right back.
This is Insider's Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Valerie, welcome. It is amazing to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Pierre. I'm excited to be here.
Likewise. Valerie, before we jump in, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the arc of your career.
Yeah, no, that would be wonderful. I started actually on the trading desk at Bear Stearns in 2007. So I definitely started at a market top. And I like to joke that I'm a reformed Chicken Little, because when that kind of frames your foundational start, it went from very high flying to very rough and not having a job very quickly. So that was an interesting experience, to say the least. But then I came back to Canada, started trading equities for institutional clients, quickly moved to the U.S. and back in 2010, because the Canadian market was hot in 2010. So they needed people to trade Canadian equities because gold was having a run. So were energy equities. And so Canada was the place to be at that time. And so I helped trade Canadian equities for U.S. clients in New York City. I was in New York City for about 7 years total before I moved to New Zealand. And there, sat on the Macquarie Institutional Equity Trading Desk and traded Australian and New Zealand equities for their pension fund clients, their largest institutional clients, before winding up at RBC in 2020 on the ETF desk. So I've been here for almost 6 years now and really immersed in the ETF world.
Wow. What an amazing...
it's a real global journey, but it's great to be back in Canada.
Yeah, what an amazing career track. Valerie, thank you so much for being here. I'm, you know, really looking forward to our conversation. Walk us through what the RBC ETF market making desk actually does. What does the day-to-day look like there?
Yeah, I'd be happy to walk through that. So I sit on a desk. We're a team of six here. The core trading team is four traders. And so every day we kind of come in, we get these files overnight, which are the basket files of all the ETFs that we make markets on. So, you know, now it's kind of upward of 1,000 different ETFs here in Canada. So our trading technology team gets all these baskets overnight. If there's been any movements or changes in the underlying securities of the ETFs, we have very robust trading technology. energy that takes that all in. It speaks to our systems in the morning, recalibrates all of our market making models. And then the traders kind of process everything, get started for the 9:30 market open. And from then on, we're monitoring the market making activity that we're doing on the ETFs that we're quoting on. And then, of course, all day long, we are taking and trading ETFs live as they come in. This is the beautiful thing about the ETF is that there's intraday liquidity, and we help source that liquidity, provide that liquidity, and really interact with a number of different facets of the ETF world.
What does being a designated broker mean in practice for an ETF issuer and for end investors?
That's a great question. So every ETF is legally obligated to have a designated broker. And the designated broker, we have signed a contractual agreement to say that we will be out there providing two-sided liquidity for that specific ETF, kind of no matter what the conditions, we'll be out there, we will give you a bid, we will give you an offer. And this is very important because this is kind of the backbone, the foundation of an exchange-traded fund. We're putting the E piece into this, and it's critical. The key differentiator between a mutual fund is to have that intraday liquidity. And so a designated broker is contractually obligated. The next level is just kind of the market maker, or a term you'll hear used is authorized participant. So in addition to our 300 designated broker mandates, we quote and provide liquidity and market making services in almost an additional 700, 800 ETFs that are listed in Canada as well. But we're not contractually obligated. So if we needed to step back or in any capacity, we could do that because there would be another designated broker that would be there.
If you asked sometimes even the most seasoned advisors to explain how an index fund or something like an index ETF rather works, it's more complicated than people realize. And, you know, all the moving parts and the participants, you as a designated broker, All those aspects of what's going on behind the curtain in ETF trading are probably parts of the market that most people, even the most seasoned advisors, are not entirely aware of.
Totally. I think it is definitely an unappreciated part of being able to access these strategies through an ETF wrapper. And we like to say, instead of behind the scenes, it's behind the screens. And, you know, an advisor, anyone using an ETF will put in their ticker and see the bids and the offers and just think that's it. But there is a lot that's happening below the surface. And the market making community is a key part of that functionality.
And it's certainly over the last 10, 15 years, the ETF market has been tested several times. I mean, on some very big occasions as to the liquidity function, all of the, you know, moving parts that, you know, keeping them moving smoothly, the plumbing working. What has that been like at those times when there have been things like a flash crash, or, you know, what happens in your space when those kinds of eventualities occur?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what we're finding now more than anything is that the ETFs being able to step up is a feature, not a bug. And so we just saw the most recent one of these flash crashes was the Liberation Day event last year, where the S&P bounced like 9% intraday as soon as we were getting this 3-month relief on the tariffs. And in this case, we actually found that SPY and other S&P 500 indices, or their ETFs rather, could act as that release valve for the pressure in the system. So as we had this massive intraday move, there's obviously a lot of buying pressure that came into the markets, and the ETF was able to step in and absorb that pressure. And actually, in many cases, I think kind of buffer the move to a certain extent. So I think it's really showing the utility of the ETF wrapper, and that really can be a provider of liquidity rather than something that is in the way of itself.
There's a very sort of reassuring element knowing that you know, all of the stakeholders, including yourself, are actually able to carry all of that off, that kind of pressure, especially very smoothly on behalf of investors, on behalf of the issuers as well, to make sure that the machine's functioning properly. That gives you a very important view on markets as well as a whole, in terms of like the view from 30,000 feet, what's happening across equities or fixed income, what's happening across all the various instruments that are traded within the ETF wrapper. What's the RBC Capital Markets view on equities over the next 12 to 18 months? What are some of the yellow flags that you're perhaps watching?
Yeah, this is, I think, the beautiful part of my job and something that I love the most is this kind of macro lens, is the fact that ETFs touch a myriad of asset classes. And in fact, an increasing amount of asset classes, as we're seeing like the rise of structured products within an ETF or the rise of private equity or people trying to figure out the private equity piece, whether it's replication or private credit, they're trying, right? So we get this beautiful lens kind of across the entire spectrum of markets at large. So when it comes down to the RBC house view, listen, this is less actually the house view. It's my view. This has been an uncomfortable rally right now, right? It's the breadth has been so narrow. It's been a very small amount of stocks driving this bounce higher off the March lows, and it's been incredibly almost parabolic. So it's a bit uncomfortable when it's a small group of stocks that are really powering the move. And so to your point, there are a few yellow flags kind of coinciding with this rally as well. And so that would be, of course, that, you know, the U.S. 10-year is through 4.5%. It's a pretty high level. Of course, we've also have the inflation shock with crude prices moving higher. Now, this is still up for debate. We don't have the crystal ball. How long will crude prices stay elevated? What is the trickle-down effect into the economy? But there certainly are a few yellow flags. The RBC house view is that when we zoom out and we look at this really robust earnings seasons we've just come out of, we look at AI really revolutionizing our world as we know it. There is a lot to love, and I think we're still constructive when you look at stocks 12 to 18 months from now. So that's all good. And if we were to see a 5 to 10% correction here, even from my trading seat, I say this is healthy. You know, consolidation is important, kind of build a new base to have that next leg of growth higher. So I think there's things to look forward to, but there's also, yeah, a few yellow flags waving right now, in our opinion.
In your seat and on your floor, it must be of critical concern because you're sitting in between all parties. And you have to match their trades, and you have to match the spread. You know, you have to figure out, you know, the spreads. There's probably a lot that a lot more than meets the eye than people realize, I think, than most people in the industry, I would say, even think going on in your space.
The really interesting thing, I think, from the ETF perspective is that we've seen a big shift. So historically, let's say 5-8 years ago, when there was risk off periods or people kind of pulling back, ETFs saw net outflows. So people kind of just like generally risk off and pulling money out of ETF assets. What we've seen in recent periods of weakness, whether that was 2022 at large, whether it was April of last year, March of this year with the Iran war breaking out, is actually fund flows moved higher. And that's because investors are now reallocating that capital. Even if they're moving risk off, they're putting that into other places in the ETF landscape. So they're moving that into whether it's ultra short duration or gold or, you know, like we mentioned, a more conservative, maybe a buffered product, something else. They're looking for alternatives. They're not just like pulling their capital and their assets out of the ETFs at large. They are just rotating it, moving it elsewhere across kind of the spectrum.
Yeah, and naturally you get to see that being fully involved in the entire space.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on gold? When the conflict broke out in Iran, people expected gold to go perhaps higher. It had been showing signs of consolidation during the beginning of the year in February. That was after a very large increase in price over the past year. Being on both sides, how would you describe what happened?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of like incongruent timing there and a bit of idiosyncratic moves that kind of put the lid on gold when you typically expect it to move higher. You alluded to it. It had this massive run, right? And I think it was a reminder that gold doesn't have a negative correlation to equities. It's got a zero correlation to equities. And so that just introduces what we kind of saw in March, right? And the house view at the start of the year, you know, excluding anyone forecasting a war to break out in the Middle East was that we thought that the gold price still had merit here, because one thing we thought was going to continue was this level of uncertainty, especially with the Trump administration. You know, anything can happen at this point, and gold should do well or hold value in an uncertain, more volatile world. If things went south, then potentially again another case for a bid to the gold story. But in any case, we still kind of are constructive. I think we've got our 2026 kind of range for year end of 4,800, which is still up 8% from current levels, and then an even higher level going into 2027, just kind of based on global demand. So, you know, it did have a fiery start and kind of retracement at the start of this year, but looking forward, we still see this as, again, a nice diversifier in a portfolio, especially in this market where I think diversifiers are becoming even more and more important.
You see central banks holding with a hawkish tilt. What does that mean for how advisors should be positioned?
And these conversations we're having now is, I think, again, a renewed focus on yield, is looking for places where I can enhance my yield on a risk-adjusted basis, especially if we're looking forward to a flat policy rate for the next kind of 12 to 18 months with, you know, the potential move for rates moving higher. But that's not crystal clear yet, too. It all depends on kind of a bunch of macro conditions and how those shake out. But what we're seeing advisors actually even do in terms of flows is look at different places, different mechanisms to go out and find yield and add yield to a portfolio.
I've sort of observed that, you know, the term that's become quite ubiquitous is higher for longer where rates are concerned. There's been certainly a lot of rate volatility, oscillation between, you know, just below on the 10-year, you mentioned the U.S. Treasury, the 10-year U.S. Treasury, there was oscillation between 4.5 down to below 4 and back up to 4, you know, back up to 4.5. My observation is just that the higher for longer statement is not fully understood by the market, by investors. The idea that we're going to go back to the zero inflation, zero interest rate era that we had the previous 15 years. We're sort of at the end. We've turned the corner on this 40-year cycle, and 2022 was really the first wake-up call, the signal that broke the 60-40 portfolio, in a manner of speaking. I think there's a lot of people, judging by the amount of commentary that's occurring in the market, there's a lot of people that are still clinging to the 60-40 model. Something else has sort of grown in its place, right? That was certainly an inflection point. What do you think specifically changed about advisor behavior that you're observing after 2022? How different were the conversations?
Yeah, like 2022 broke all the rules, right? And traditional ballasts are not working in the way that they were expected to work, and they still, since 22, haven't been functioning as ballast, as capital preservation within a portfolio. And as you alluded to, we really have seen kind of this proliferation of an entirely new branch of the ETF ecosystem. And the kind of starter product of this was one with the ticker BALT, which stands for B bond alternative. And the whole idea behind this product, it's a buffered product, was a bond alternative. So you can put this in your portfolio. It's going to have a cap and it's going to have a downside buffer, and you're going to fund the downside buffer with selling away the cap. And then therefore your client can experience, again, I think they've backtested, a better risk-adjusted return. You're participating in some capital upside, but you do know you've got capital preservation down to a certain level. And so we've seen this big rise of products. I think now in the U.S. there's over 500 ETFs that have a derivatives-based strategy within them. And there's, you know, it's like Baskin-Robbins, not even 31 flavors. It's, I guess, 500 at this point, right? But it's because there's so many different variables, and you can toggle those variables, each one. And then so it gets exponential really quickly in the amount of products. But I think, again, this is the beauty of the ETF solution. And, you know, you hear pushback all the time. There's so many ETFs. Are there too many ETFs? There's more ETFs than stocks. But the reality is that the ETF used to be a very blunt force object. You could just buy like the index, right? And that's what it's known for and used for. But now we can get so much specificity within an ETF that it becomes this almost surgical precision tool that you can use to access very specific targets and goals within a specific strategy. So I think this is this proliferation of this new wave of ETFs is really beneficial for investors and advisors. But the caveat is they do require a bit more due diligence and understanding of what you're buying.
Yeah, they're both beneficial and complex at the same time. But I agree with you that you know, as tools in a toolkit or on a tool wall that, you know, advisors can choose from, there's every kind of, you know, like what's emerging is every kind of flavor of risk management that you can think of, that the ETF issuer marketplace can think of as well. It feels like at times that you know, like certain cohorts of investors, whether it's the, you know, retiree or the near retiree or the younger, you know, the youngs, want instruments that they're finding within ETFs that provide a certain amount of instant gratification, like covered calls. You get to participate in the equity market. These are all mostly long-only equity funds, but with the overlay, you get the instant gratification of income. If you're a retiree, it's terrific because you can use you know, a growth asset to fund part of your retirement income. But as a younger investor, you're getting something without having to wait for all the growth. You know, you're not having to wait 10, 15, 20 years to get the growth of your portfolio. You're getting something as you go along. You're getting a paycheck. What do you think when it comes to covered calls and other derivative income-based strategies like that? What do you think might be one of the things or a couple of things that advisors and investors alike might be missing when it comes to sort of perceiving how they actually work or what's actually important to know?
Again, cover call products, they use derivatives within them. And so I would say this does require, again, an extra level of understanding, doing your due diligence. And I like to say you should be able to understand the strategy well enough to explain it to your neighbor or family member, right? And same with cover call ETFs. The spectrum is quite wide. We have so many products now, and the deliverables and the stated goals and objectives of ETFs within the cover call world is again very wide. And so something that might sound the same by name, sound the same on label, actually has a very, very different mechanisms behind the hood. And there again, like I said, there's so many variables. Is this strategy actively managed? Is it running off a quantitative strategy? Again, neither is inherently better than the other. It's just important to understand. Is it a portfolio manager that's going out there looking at the range of NVIDIA calls and picking the one that she thinks is optimal or the best strike price where they can really maximize harvesting that vol without giving up too much upside? And then there's a whole, you know, all the options variables, again, in the moneyness. And then how much of the portfolio is being overwritten? Are they overwriting on 80% of the portfolio, in which that would heavily cap your upside? Are they only overwriting on 10% of the portfolio, in which 90% of the stocks that are held are getting the full capital appreciation to the upside? So there is a lot going on. I think in the past, we would have advisors call in. They just searched by yield, highest to lowest, and worked their way down the list. But the reality is like all things in finance, there's always a trade-off. And so if you're getting something, you're always trading something off to receive what you are getting. And so it's important that when you're looking at products and making that product selection decision, that you are understanding what trade-offs are at play here.
It's interesting how your desk, your floor, your trading floor is at the nexus of institutions, retail investors, retail advisors, family offices. So you're hearing from pretty much everybody on the strategy front, where, you know, people are calling you and asking, you know, what should we do? What do you think about this? But you're also, because you're all there together, you get to see what's happening in real time as well. That's pretty exciting.
It is very exciting. And we can see sometimes the flows moving to each other. Sometimes you can see that actually it's the retail money that is in some ways like acting smarter, being less reactive, which has somehow, you know, benefited them into these market rallies. The kind of buy the dip signal that, again, retail investors now have almost like as a muscle memory, because it's been such a positive driver of returns for them over the past 3 years. It's kind of this innate, just kind of, I got to move if the market's down. And so in some ways, I think they've been more successful than sometimes trades that we see happen come out of the institutional world.
Amazing. Valerie, on your what are your thoughts on private assets in ETF wrapper? There's been quite a lot of controversy around things like the crossover ETF, the XOVR this past year, or PRIV. Why hasn't it taken off despite the demand for private assets?
Yeah, I think there's just like some innate behaviors between the two that are incongruent. The ETF is built on transparency and built on liquidity. Within private assets, you are getting enhanced return because you are kind of trading away that liquidity and in some cases that transparency, right? Like that money goes away and it's in many ways locked up to a certain extent, has a certain hurdle rate, and then you can transact. And so I think there's kind of like these two things that are very kind of different, square peg, round hole. Now that said, we have a lot of bright minds in the asset management world that are trying to work through this. And we're seeing different strategies come to market, the ones that you mentioned, of course. We've also saw Goldman Sachs launch a private equity replication strategy. So again, they've got a few things going on in the basket where they're trying to give that private equity-like return with that private equity-like risk profile and deliver that within the tradable liquid ETF structure. So there are some natural hurdles that I think the industry is still very much working through, but it is exciting to see, because I think this is going to be a continued place of innovation here, and people are going to keep trying to have kicks at the can.
The biggest problem that seems to occur when it comes to private assets is not the private asset itself. Very often those private assets are terrific assets to own. They're very well run. They've got great teams. But the problem is the liquidity perception, the liquidity mismatch, because the ETF is supposed to be daily liquid, but the private assets aren't, which you spoke to. Maybe the actual solution to the problem would be if it's possible, of course, for investors, you know, looking to invest in private assets through an ETF wrapper, to have different expectations, time horizon-wise, for that private asset ETF, to treat it as though it's illiquid rather than something, oh, I can get rid of it tomorrow if I don't like it.
Yeah, I can get in and out quickly. It does also, as you can imagine, increase complications from a market maker perspective too, because we, like our ability to price is based upon our ability to understand where we can offload that risk, right? And so the tighter and the more certain we are at where we can know we can unwind our position, the tighter our spread can be. If we don't have clarity or there's lack of certainty on where that exit is, then it makes it much more difficult for our trading systems to run and kind of provide these tight quotes that people are now used to in the ETF world. So there are a lot of complexities, and, you know, it's just a few things to work through. But we'll see how this evolves. Because, again, to your point, you know, I don't know if we can like trust investors enough to say like, oh, this is, I need to just like let this ride, because that's the other thing too, is we talked about market shocks. You know, if something moved sideways, then, you know, you need to make sure that there's a buyer there that can step in as well. So there's a lot of play.
We kind of saw that in February, right? With the SaaS apocalypse, or the SaaS stock meltdown that happened when Anthropic came on the scene with their new iteration. I think when you look at that, and then that subsequently, or that coincidentally, led to private credit that's SaaS related to lock up as well,
yes,
or the gate. I mean, to gate redemptions. Again, it seems like a lot of the problems arose from, you know, the misperception of what liquidity investors actually had. Was it 5% a quarter? Was it 5%, you know, was it so much percentage a year that you could actually look to redeem? But when investors are looking for liquidity, that can almost result in not caring, like, just give me my money back.
Yeah. And, right? And that's the thing to your point, too, is that as you talked about, the designated broker or lead market maker in the U.S., there's someone that has to step in. We can't just say, like, oh, we're gating redemptions or you cannot trade this. And we have to have that exit in the ETF structure. And so that's very important, I think, integral to, you know, being able to provide these solutions. And then also to your point, too, about you saying that, you know, maybe investors could just treat it as a long-term holding. It made me think of, you know, famously, Jack Bogle was not a fan of ETFs because he believed that having the accessibility and intraday liquidity actually would cause investors to turn over their portfolios more when the right thing is just to buy and hold. And so it's hard to tell people just hold these. And if your time horizon is long enough, you'll be good. But the ETF has to be there. And I think that's the tricky part in trying to marry the ETF structure with private assets.
Well, the funny thing that happens, also to your point, Valerie, is that when investors are looking for cash because they've got margin calls from some other part of their portfolio, you know, they'll often reach for the best performing assets. That included gold in the last quarter. That included some of these private credit assets that had done very well up until that moment. But when you're you know, starved for cash and you need to raise money, you tend to go, you know, the low hanging fruit tends to be the best performing asset, and certainly gold was one of them. So you can see where you know, the market making landscape gets very challenging. You have to be very selective as a firm, as a designated broker and authorized participant. You got to be very selective about who you allow into your space.
Yes, absolutely. And certainly as, you know, more and more products are coming to market as well, we are being more selective because at the end of the day, it costs us time and resources and we're holding inventory and all of these inputs that go into our market making book. And it's actually not a super profitable business. And so many times when we are providing these services, they come at a loss to our desk because they are expensive to run. And so we do, as part of our due diligence in the relationship when we set up a DB mandate, is understanding why the strategy was built, why this product is coming to market, and what the distribution plan of this product is, because, you know, liquidity begets liquidity. So in order to have a successful product, you need to have a very solid distribution plan.
So Valerie, we're seeing nearly $1 in every $8 that's going into Canadian ETFs now flowing into asset allocation products like all-in-one ETFs, like some of the EQT products that are out there, like XEQT or I think ZEQT at BMO. And what's driving that and who is using them?
It's been absolutely incredible. And it was the story of 2025 and it continues to be a story into 2026 as well. I've been calling it the Pac-Man of ETF flows because it's just this little thing that every day is coming in and taking in those inflows. It's incredible. And we've also see a step up of inflows in times of volatility and uncertainty. I think, again, it's become this rotation into something that's secure and I just go back into this kind of default portfolio, or if I'm dollar cost averaging or investing regularly, that if I'm uncertain about the trajectory of the markets, that I can just come back to a specific one ticker solution. And it is wild. I think even the timing, I think it's caught a lot of people off guard, the success and the rampant success. They've been around for 5 or 6 years now. Vanguard did a study a while ago, and they were really the pioneers here about knowing this was a solution that people were looking for. But it was a really slow burn for people to get excited about it. But it's been a meteoric takeoff. And when it comes down to who are using these products, again, I think the spectrum is very wide, which is why the fund flows have been so incredible. So, of course, we see the DIY investor. You know, I think it was first brought to my attention about 2 years ago now, the Reddit community that is XEQT and chill, or just XEQT it. So there's this natural kind of groundswell of appreciation that happened organically for XEQT. We've also seen a lot of strength going into the Fidelity products. At first, they were the ones to include a small slice of Bitcoin ETF within them, which gave them a lot of outperformance. And they also have a balanced portfolio, FBAL, that has done very well from a fund flows perspective. And then, of course, as I mentioned, Vanguard was really the grandfather of these products. And they also have Bogleheads and all the believers there. But beyond just the retail investor, the DIY investor, we're also seeing advisors increasingly use these products as solutions for low touch portfolios. So maybe it's a client's grandchild's RESP or a grandchild account, and they can just set it and forget it. And it really is this easy button to investing. And I think just the ability to access it through a one ticker solution and know you're getting, whether it's five underlying ETFs or the exposure of 10 to, in the case of Fidelity, some of them have 16 ETFs within the single ticker. It's about getting that kind of breadth within a very narrow depth of just choosing one ticker to fit those needs.
It took quite a while for the these strategies to get adopted. And would you say it was 2022 that sort of triggered the takeoff?
Yeah, I think so. But again, even then, it was a very, very still slow burn. It just honestly felt like someone dropped a match on, you know, the kindling, I would say, at the start, end of 24. And it just really has become its own, you know, asset class in many ways now. It's so big and attracting so many flows. It's just nothing shy of impressive. We also have just seen now CIBC enter to what has been, in my mind now, is very crowded space, right? But their all-in-one solution, one of their asset allocation solutions, I should say, is CAGE. I think it's the fastest growing ETF in Canada to get to 400 million in assets. It was only launched about 8 weeks ago now. I think it's something like 40 trading days without kind of this bring your own assets or some kind of internal allocation to the fastest kind of hit that level with just kind of a good buzz, really, and a good story. And again, impressive considering they're kind of later to the game and it's now an increasingly crowded space. But as long as you have a differentiator and a story to tell, I think that can make a successful product. And CIBC has done very well with this ETF with the ticker CAGE.
They've got a great story. I mean, I think that you're talking about the all-in-one that's managed by Avantis, right? And is it safe to say that these all-in-ones, I think we might have already covered this, but the all-in-one asset allocation category is the entry point for a whole new generation of ETF investors? Would that be the younger cohort?
Yes, I think you're also seeing some people in the older cohort as well use this as like a core satellite position, right? And so they can use that as their core. I was actually recently out talking to our largest ultra high net worth direct investors. So many of these do have advised assets as well, but they're managing some on their own. And, you know, these portfolios are tens of millions of dollars in size. And I think that a lot of them are kind of using this to kind of act as a core and then be able to build single stock positions or other positions around using an asset allocation at the heart of their portfolios as well. So I wouldn't say it's just limited to young investors, although they certainly are definitely part of the growth here.
For me, it was a head scratcher why it was taking so long for these very sophisticated asset allocation products to get that kind of adoption. I always thought it was kind of, you know, this is the solution to a lot of people's sort of headaches about, you know, where do I go? How much do I allocate? What's the right position sizing? All of those questions are sort of addressed directly by the issuer. A lot of investors have moved away from the duration side, and then which is a great decision, especially in the last couple of years with interest rates being higher for longer and perhaps going higher like they have recently, and especially in the duration end of the market, 10 to 30 years. For advisors and investors alike, it seems to have been one of the bigger nuts to crack. Like, what do I do with that 40% of my portfolio that was, you know, in an ag or, you know, in an ag type fund or in a broadly diversified bond fund? It's been kind of surprising, especially since 2022, that you know, rates, especially in the face of subsequently the Fed and Bank of Canada cutting rates, that long term yields continued to stay high or go higher in some cases. We've turned the corner on that 40 years of falling long-term yields, and you had an apt way of describing what TLT has been to investors.
Yeah, well, I said TLT has been a widow maker for the past 5 years. Like really, since the COVID shock, the people have tried, and TLT has spurts, but before it gives it all back up again, and it kind of gets to a level, and people start to take like interesting. I want to get long duration here, but nothing just comes right back down, and it's been a very, very challenging trade, and I think it has made a lot of widows along the way here. And to your point, like duration isn't working in the current environment, and so people are looking to other solutions to enhance their yield. And so we've seen actually recently in this kind of risk on period that we're having a big influx back to aggregate bond products. And I think they're just kind of doing some risk reward analysis and understanding that that's going to be their best bang for their buck right now. We're also seeing a lot of movement into actively managed fixed income products that are unconstrained. So it gives the portfolio manager to be very selective, understanding like the companies and where they're buying their bonds and what ones they seem deemed to be most attractive, and really just kind of giving them, you know, open season to go out and pick the bonds that they want to own right now. And then the other area that I think we've seen growing interest and again have seen a big pickup in inflows recently is back into the AAA CLO ETF field, which again is kind of new to a lot of people because before, you know, CLOs were really the domain of institutional investors. They had high minimums. You needed access to be able to trade them. But now you get this democratization through the ETF structure that kind of anyone can go out and buy a CLO ETF. And the AAA CLOs are very interesting because in their 40-year history, they have never defaulted because they're securitized loans. So, you know, it has never reached the level at the top level, the top tier, to see like any defaults. So there's some interesting yields available on the CLO space. But again, it would come to with the caveat is there are trade-offs and you should know what you're buying.
During the period where we had long-term yields falling from the 80s to, you know, recently, 2020, 2021, the thing that was attractive in addition to the yields was the duration, was the convexity.
Yes.
That you got from owning long duration bonds when those yields on those long duration bonds were falling. We've got the opposite kind of thing happening now. There's also been the reemergence of the term premium because investors want more return for the risk that they're taking, which has also lifted yields to slightly higher than people expected, made that TLT trade a widow maker, as you put it, which I love that. Going back a couple of years, I was amazed to hear that TLT was attracting, you know, billions of dollars in flows every month from investors, you know, maybe tactically looking for a turn in the long-term yields, or some other reason, but there was billions of dollars flowing into TLT, and that was a head scratcher. And what are you seeing maybe happening in some of the other areas like of alternatives, like CTAs, for example, like trend following strategies or CTAs where you get a positive drift, a positive carry from something like a CTA strategy, a trend following strategy, but you also get the potential for convexity against the bond market. Are we seeing any sort of increase in flows in candidates become very popular? There's a rising popularity in those strategies, or, you know, new sort of revisiting of that strategy in the ETF market in the US. Are we seeing anything like that happening in Canada?
Yeah, no, but not to the same level. But I would say that this dynamic that you've just described has really kind of formed this rise of the alternatives. And it really is about people looking at overall portfolio construction, looking for the gaps that they're trying to solve for and trying to find appropriate products that can fill for those gaps. And so, you know, there's everything that on offer now that they can access, and so they can look, is it CTAs, is it trend following strategy that I want to own, is it just simply a cover call overriding that I can tactically rotate into if I think valuations are looking expensive and I want to harvest volatility, or is it these kind of structured note product ETFs? There's auto callable ETFs now. There's so many different, again, trade-offs and strategies that are mixing and matching all those trade-offs together that it's a very wide menu now for advisors to choose from. But I certainly think the macro environment that you're just describing has really fostered the growth here.
Let's talk briefly about thematics. What's driving the move from sector ETFs towards more targeted thematic exposure? Like investors are sort of getting out of the GIC sectors and moving to more thematic baskets.
Yeah, I would just say that in many ways now, GICs are kind of antiquated. They are just kind of old school. They are not matching where we're seeing the growth in the stock market at large. And they also aren't providing like the hedges or the ability to short the exact basket that I want to short on the other side, right? They're coming to these kind of wide swatches of the market, but they're not accurately representing how investors want to tactically bet, either a long bet or a short bet. And as of this, we've seen kind of this shift back into the thematic ETF. And so right now, again, like we've seen a big rise in innovation. We've seen a rise in U.S. infrastructure. That ticker is PAVE. We've seen a big push into space ETFs. We've seen memory chip ETFs. We've seen just a Mag7 ETF. We have seen these like much more narrow slivers of kind of the baskets of the underlying. And I think, again, this talks to the precision that people want more precise tools, and that the GIC sectors ETFs are not as relevant as they were 10, 15 years ago.
You recently talked about DRAM as well on a Bloomberg interview, right?
Yeah, how can you not talk about DRAM? It's the buzziest one, and even just now another fresh $1 billion. The rally has kind of moved sideways for a few days, but it still has another $1 billion of capital flowing into the fund. And I think they just really capitalize on a niche. And the other key thing is that there's almost zero overlap between DRAM and the S&P 500. So it's the perfect complement. You are not double dipping. You're not overexposing yourself. You are really adding that very targeted, very niche satellite exposure. And if you see more upside for memory chip makers here, then it's a no-brainer to access that through DRAM, especially because going out and buying SK Hynix listed in South Korea is near impossible to do on your own. So again, it's just a proof point of ETF as an access vehicle, providing that to the end investors. And it's been very, very impressive to watch.
I bet. I mean, you've got the front row seat there. And it's a lot more than meets the eye, even though it's a 12 stock ETF.
Yes.
It's a little bit more complicated to carry off than it appears at first, right? Valerie, what are your thoughts on single stock ETFs?
I think, again, it's just a differentiated access point for investors. It's not right for every investor, but if you want to buy almost like a fractional share and you can't buy the full share of Google, you can access that through a single stock ETF. Also, many of them have either a covered call overlay or a levered covered call overlay. So they're deploying a little bit of leverage to then even overwrite and harvest volatility. So you can see in some of the very volatile single stocks like Nvidia and Tesla come to mind, is that actually they can enhance return over certain periods. Now, that said, they can also put a cap on the kind of unlimited return if you were just able to own the underlying stock itself. But again, it's just a case of know your trade-offs. And I think that there is a very valid, many valid cases out there for why they should exist and a gap that they can fill in the market.
Yeah, very interesting. I would say that very interesting tools, very interesting access points for investors looking for income from their growth stocks.
Yeah.
And I think the part that maybe gets overlooked if you haven't done your homework is the kind of yield that's possible, especially on some of the more volatile names, because you are harvesting volatility when you buy a covered call single stock.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
There's something I wanted to get into with you before we wrap. And this is the liquidity misconceptions that clients have that you deal with every day, right? How should advisors think about ETF liquidity beyond trading volume? And where do investors most often misread what low volume actually means?
Yeah, it's incredible. And every day never ceases to amaze me. I was actually on ETF.com last week, and it prompted me with this pop-up that says, what's the key driver of liquidity in an ETF? And I clicked, it's the liquidity of the underlying securities, thinking that this was a very easy multiple choice. But only 24% of respondents had selected that. And the lion's share had selected on-screen book and ADV maybe, which it has a role, sure, but in some ways, I'm like, this can be further from the truth. It really is how liquid is the underlying basket in the ETF, and that is how liquid the ETF is. And so we are constantly doing that education process and running through. There's three different layers of liquidity within ETF, and it's very different from when you go out and buy a stock, right? Like a stock just has the secondary market. Unless there is a primary offering, IPO, or some kind of unlock, the amount of shares outstanding is finite. With an ETF, we can go out, we can create, or we can destroy those shares. And so that provides this big level of price elasticity, especially if the underlying securities themselves are very liquid. So if it is an ETF that holds NASDAQ 100 stocks, we should be able to go out and be able to execute that. What we say here is like at the touch, like just get it done very seamlessly at where it's currently trading. In some cases, we might be, our books might be a certain way where we can price actually inside the fair value of the basket of securities. And so the quick three layers of liquidity are interacting on the market with another natural buyer or seller. The second level is interacting with a market maker book, which is where we would come into play at RBC Capital Markets. And the third layer of liquidity is tapping into that creation redemption mechanism, where we go and we liaise with BlackRock iShares, with BMO GAM, with, you know, whoever we've talked about already today. And we can go out and we can exchange the securities for new shares of the ETF, or the reverse as well. So it's a big part of my job is walking through the process and why you should not be scared off if you pull up an ETF that you want to buy, that it's only traded 1,000 shares for the past week, because it more depends on the liquidity of the underlying basket itself.
That's really interesting. I think, you know, when investors understand that, they won't be as scared, you know, the way they might be if they were looking at a low volume stock.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And that's different. Yeah.
It's an entirely different ballgame. And we're there to provide a pleasant experience transacting ETFs. Like, our business does well the more people that are trading ETFs. So we want people to have a good experience when they're either buying or if they're selling ETFs as well, to understand that they're not being ripped off by a faceless market maker, and that the market making community is very competitive, and there is this market this natural arbitrage within the ETF that keeps everyone honest as well. So, you know, if we're pricing at a certain level, but another bank thinks they can price that risk more competitively, they will come in and do that. Or if they see some kind of gap that we are disadvantageous in the market, they will come in and close that gap. So the arbitrage mechanism keeps everyone in the business very honest. And I like to use the analogy that in many cases, we're just like being at a grocery store, and we're, let's say, the bakery department, and the bakery puts up two cakes because they sell on average two chocolate cakes a day. And you come in and you say, oh, shoot, they only have two cakes. I've got to cater for 10 cakes. Because we're the grocery store, we can go out, we can go buy more flour. It's on our shelves. We've got eggs, we've got vanilla, we've got cocoa powder, whatever you need. We've got it. We just have to go out and get it for you when you tell us you want 10 cakes. And so the analogy is just use a limit order when you're trading ETFs. You can use a limit order, you know, within the direction you're going, so you make sure you get executed. But it lets us know as market makers that there's more either supply or demand in the market. We can go out and we can start making those cakes and put those cakes on the shelves for then you to hopefully transact with and take home with you. So we can kind of access the ingredients to be able to provide additional ETF liquidity if we know it's warranted and there's another side to that trade.
I love the bakery analogy. That's a terrific way of thinking about it. Are there any other trading practices advisors should adopt that still most aren't doing?
It's just like be a considerate trader. So what that means to me is understanding what you're trading. Is that market closed or open? You know, if you are trading Japan, our hours will almost never overlap. That's not a problem because we will proxy hedge that risk. But it's important to know, am I trading Europe? In which case Europe is open to about usually midday in North American times. Those are probably best to transact then within the 10 a.m. to 12 a.m., let's say Eastern window, because again, we can probably quote tighter because we know where we can get off our risk on the other side, which again just should improve the execution level. The other thing is to you can avoid the open, and sometimes the close can be a little bit noisy, and then use a limit order to kind of again make sure you're protecting your own price and make sure you are going to get your best execution. And now I will also say that you can reach out if you have a retail desk or a friendly trading desk that you can reach out to. Oftentimes we will walk advisors through execution processes, understanding what they're trying to do, and maybe even give them a few ways that they can transact in the ETF and ways that we can help them. So if you do have access to talking to a trading desk, that's always a plus as well.
Fantastic. Valerie, wow. I mean, fantastic conversation. I mean, the breadth of everything that we talked about is amazing. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
No, great. Thanks so much, Pierre, for having me. I appreciate it.